The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
If instead Putin doubles down, then so shall we, further ratcheting up economic pressure and supporting Ukraine with finance.
Sanctions have to be as powerful as they can possibly be. We will be pushing the government to go further and faster.
We could have a massive miscalculation and we will then be in a full-scale war across the globe.
You're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And good afternoon, I'm Caroline Hepke. Coming up on today's programme, we'll talk to Bloomberg's political editor, Kitty Donaldson, about what she's watching out for in terms of what promises to be a major week for Westminster.
And Bloomberg opinion columnist Julian Lee will talk us through what's going on with the fuel crisis.
And later in the programme, we're joined by James Baum, who is the senior economist at Make UK, the manufacturers group.
But first, when the clock strikes midnight tonight, 40,000 rail workers are going to go on strike. It marks the largest rail strike in decades as unions push for pay to keep up with the rising cost of living.
Now, the Transport Secretary Grant Shapps says that the strikes are not necessary.
I think it's a huge act of self-harm to go on strike at the moment. I don't believe workers are anywhere near as militant as their unions, who are leading them up a garden path. They're gunning for the strike. It's completely unnecessary.
So that was Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary. Now the RMT boss, Mick Lynch, has defended the walkouts.
We're facing a crisis for our members. We're faced with thousands of job cuts, despite what Grant Shapps says. They've told us that they're going to extend the working week from 35 hours to 40 or possibly 44. And for new entrants, that will mean lower wages.
Well, that was Rail Union boss Mick Lynch. Well, let's get the latest on a busy week ahead. A-level results, Glastonbury, and of course, two important by-elections all happening during this week of rail strikes. Well, let's catch up with Bloomberg's UK political editor, Kitty Donaldson. Kitty, thanks so much for joining us on Bloomberg Westminster. Just talk us through some of the key political things we're looking forward to this week.
Yeah, hi there. So I think the key things this week are strikes, as you said, and then the by-elections on Thursday. Let's start with strikes, shall we? As of midnight London time tonight, all these people are going out on strike, and it means that basically pretty much no one can get to work unless you live in central London and can get a bus somewhere. And this is causing quite a big headache for the government, and they're trying to push it on to Labour. If you look at some of the campaigning they're running, they're blaming the Tory. I've just seen a Tory MP tweet something he's just mocked up, I think, on his computer, basically comparing Angela Rayner, who's the deputy leader of the Labour Party, to some sort of 1970s, you know, folk hero. And I'm not sure how long this can last. I mean, the government has been in charge now for however long, a long time, and trying to blame Labour for the strikes doesn't seem to me to be particularly strategically working.
And Kitty, of course, the issue is with the strike action that it could actually broaden out to even more unions, and also the fact that the government has not intervened, as you say, directly. That's the sort of criticism that's been made, that government hasn't grabbed this issue, you know, and actually dealt with it properly itself. It sort of left it to the what it thinks of as the employers.
Yes, absolutely. Grant Shapps has come under quite a lot of fire for not getting directly and personally involved in the talks. His argument is it's a dispute between the employers and the unions, and I think there's an element of wanting to keep his hands clean and not be associated with the strikes. As you say, there are teachers. One of the teaching unions was on the radio this morning talking about wanting a 9% pay rise to match inflation. That's very unlikely to happen. And doctors are also threatening to move to go on strike as well. And we've had Simon Clark, who's chief secretary to the Treasury, and he's overseeing a pay review body, which is due to report fairly soon on what public sector workers can expect. And Clark was saying this morning that he doesn't think that they'll get pay rises that will match inflation at all. So it looks like the strikes are only going to carry on and continue and get larger.
Yeah, Kitty, I wonder if we're overestimating how far these strikes are going to hit. Certainly outside London and the South East, of course, most people drive to work. But as you say, if they spread to the NHS and into schools, then it's going to be massive, isn't it? Just talk to us about the by-elections. Two very, very different parts of the country, one in the Red Wall, one in the so-called Blue Wall in the South. I think perhaps if we've picked two places to have by-elections, then you would perhaps pick two seats like these. Really fascinating contests.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? The juxtaposition of that. These are two seats that tell us an awful lot about British politics, and it's all happening on the same day. And actually, both driven by sexual offences from the Tories who previously held them. I mean, different sorts of issues there. But let's talk about Wakefield first in the north. That's in the so-called red wall of seats that the Tories took off Labour in the 2019 election. And I was just chatting just now to my colleague Joe Mays, and he went up there last week, and he was saying what he thinks is that the Tory vote will stay at home, and therefore Labour will almost certainly win, but not because anyone particularly likes Labour, just that the Tories won't get their vote out. And that's quite interesting because of what it tells us about Conservatives' electoral prospects in 2024. That's when we expect the next election to be. It tells us that although people might be cross with the Tories midterm, doesn't necessarily mean that Labour will win the next election, at least not outright. And then there's the other seat down in Tiverton, Honiton and Tiverton in Devon, and that's a completely different picture. That's a very rural community, and it's a Lib Dem target. There was a poll last week in The Guardian, which the Lib Dems 2 points behind the Tories there. And that will be fascinating because it will send a shiver down the spine of any Tory who's defending against the Lib Dems in the southern heartlands of England if that seat goes Lib Dem on Thursday.
Yes, so it could be pretty tricky. Liz, Kitty, in terms of trying to move the government agenda on, though, from the kind of scandals of Boris Johnson, we spoke to three junior ministers last week, the head of the Treasury Select Committee. I mean, there is a real drive, isn't there, to sort of try to move on to meatier policy issues. Do you sense that?
I mean, they keep trying, don't they? You know, they'd like nothing more than to. To stop us all writing about parties and law breaking and ethics advisors and everything that goes with it. And actually, I think in some ways the narrative is shifting. It's shifting away from the sort of slightly frivolous issues. Although, I mean, you might argue that the issue of trust isn't frivolous, but away from parties, more towards kind of bread and butter stuff like the economy. I don't know, though, that the government necessarily wants voters to think about the economy, though. I mean, if you're looking at inflation goes up to 9% this week, as it's predicted to do, and 11% in the autumn, it's sort of, you know, is that what you want voters to be thinking about? I'm not sure I would if I was in charge.
Kitty, great stuff. Thanks so much for bringing us that wrap of the week. That's Bloomberg's UK political editor, Kitty Donaldson. I was looking at the odds over the weekend for the by-elections, and the Tories are a 60-1 shot to hold Wakefield. So the money, at least, pretty certain what's going to happen in that by-election anyway.
Yeah, but getting Kitty's view, you know, she's always got the finger on the pulse down in Westminster. Oh, yeah, very, very interesting moment this week, really. And I think perhaps Kitty is right, talking about the cost of filling up an average family vehicle here in the UK. That has hit £100. Weaker sterling, the rising crude oil prices have driven up costs. I mean, this is another key issue. You say many people drive to work, but this is the other fact that they're facing, how expensive it is to fill up. Now, earlier, Tom McKenzie and I spoke to Bloomberg opinion columnist Julian Lee about where that money goes and what actually might help to drive down those prices for voters.
Taxes make up a large part of the pump price of both petrol and diesel in the UK. With a price of petrol at about 187 pence a litre, £1.87, 45% of that is taxes, and that's the excise duty, which is a fixed amount. And then on top of that, we pay VAT. Not just on the underlying price of the petrol, but we pay VAT on the duty as well. And if you add all those together, that's about 45% of the price that we pay at the pump. It's about 85 pence a litre. Another 40% is the raw materials. That's the cost of the crude oil and the biofuels that go into to make the petrol. And the remainder, with about 16%, about 30 pence a litre, is the cost of processing this crude in the refinery to make it into petrol, delivery to the petrol stations, and margins for, you know, everybody involved in that process, which is a relatively small part of the overall cost.
Now, listen, we've spoken to the Petrol Retailers Association quite a few times about this, about prices on the forecourt. And there's this real blame game, isn't there, between industry and government about the any price reduction not being passed on to consumers quickly enough. That's the kind of government attack line, as it were. Is it true?
It's very difficult to sort out how true it is, because there are so many moving parts. One thing that we can see is that when the tax is cut, that is passed through fairly quickly. You can see the retail price coming down. Obviously, you know, if you cut the tax, that's only a proportion of the underlying price. At the same time that the tax was being cut, the crude oil price was going up. So that was the rise in that was offsetting some of the tax cut. And the other thing that was happening, which often seems to get forgotten, is that the value of the pound was falling. And that meant that because the crude oil is priced in dollars, every barrel of crude oil, as the price of the pound, or the value of the pound falls, costs us that little bit more when you convert it into pounds. Now, if you look back over, say, the last 10 years or so to the last time that oil prices were back above $100 a barrel, the relative price of petrol and diesel now is much higher compared with the crude cost than it was back in sort of 2011 to 2014. But over that period of time, since the Brexit referendum, the pound has lost one quarter of its value against the US dollar.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
And now for other news in the world of politics. We're joined by Bloomberg's James Wilcock today. James, good to have you on the programme. So we just heard about the inflation worries, about how much it costs to fill up your tank of petrol. But actually, British consumers are a lot more aware and certainly a lot more worried about inflation than perhaps in other parts of the world.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because these global pressures affect everyone. And you will see a lot of the government's defenders say this affects Europe, which it well does. In fact, anyway, some European countries are far more close to sort of the impact of the war in Ukraine. However, inflation is also a psychological problem. And so in some ways, we've had a large economical impact from Brexit. Mm-hmm. We also have quite a strict tax policy, which is like is very keen on sort of bringing back the deficit. But more broadly than that, consumers are feeling uncomfortable. And that will have impacts on our markets. We'll see when people cut back things like holiday spending, luxury mm-hmm. spending, anything discretionary, habits changing will also be seeing large impacts from that drop in consumer confidence. So this stuff will feed back into the wider economy.
Now, James, even before inflation took off, we've seen a big rise in buy now, pay later services, haven't we? The government today outlining measures to improve protection for consumers in this.
They want to sort of try and make the whole process more transparent. But the question is, why are they doing it and why are they doing it today? And it comes back to what Kitty was saying back at the start of the show. We're seeing strikes, we're seeing big issues with cost of living, and the government are trying to set out a path to say we're protecting you. Another thing they announced today, Ewan, was a £6 billion tax cut. Mm-hmm. They want to make it more transparent. They're launching an online tool to see how it affects you. But it kind of points to the issue that people like Martin Lewis, the money-saving expert, are pointing to, which is ultimately the only way to stop inflation is for people to take a large economic hit. So the government, in the same way with its energy bills, is taking out a slice of the pie. It's making life easier for some consumers, and it's trying its hardest to target the most vulnerable. But it can't do it completely. Otherwise, it almost defeats, in its view, it defeats the point of the legislation it's setting out.
Yeah, absolutely. It wants to sort of slow down those price rises. Having said that, there is another issue around the hit to incomes that is very significant. We've heard quite a lot more about how the decision to raise the pensionable age has affected people.
Now, you see, and so far I've been setting out the case for the government. Now, if you were the Labour Party, you would look at these figures and point to the figures saying, Caroline, that when the government raised the state pension age from 65 to 66 back in 2018, coming into place into 2020, it took from absolute poverty, which is not relative poverty, which is how many people are poor in the country in a relative way, but people who can't afford to eat, from 1 in 10 pensioners to 1 in 4. That is a staggering number. That number means 100,000 pensioners extra found it difficult to feed themselves. And when the Labour government, when the Labour opposition come in and say, are you really doing enough? Are these measures really helping enough people? They will point to figures like that and say, there needs to be far more targeted help.
And this is pushing up the pensionable age by 1 year. Mm. So you're pushing those 100,000 people into poverty.
Yeah, and the reason why it does that is when you take a claim state pension, it gives you like a certain amount per month. I think roughly £142. Mm. Now, when you have to work, say, for another year, that is what time that many people aren't in employment. So they're claiming basically universal credit benefits as opposed to a state pension. So there is a shortfall in how much money they can claim. And part of the problem for the government is people who have worse education levels, who rent, have less of a sort of nest egg to fall back on and can't get back into work.
Yeah, pension age going from 65, of course, to 67 by 2028. So a gradual creeping up of that pension age. Thanks so much for bringing us those stories. That's James Walcock.
Okay, now, another part of the economy that is suffering right now. Manufacturers in the UK want help from government to tackle rising costs, as two-thirds of firms surveyed say that rising energy bills are causing severe disruption to their businesses.
Well, Make UK says that its members are on the precipice and they need a package before Parliament's summer recess. Well, we're joined now by James Brougham. He's a senior economist at Make UK. James, thanks for joining us on Bloomberg Westminster. Now, why are so many costs going up for your members, and how much difficulty is inflation causing for them?
Yes, good morning. And I suppose that really is the key challenge at the moment. It's actually not that much of a novel challenge. It's been around now for about 3 quarters. What's happening now is this understanding that it's not going to abate anytime soon, and quite likely not right the way until 2023. So what this means for the industry is they're now seeing for the next year or so, they're going to have to endure these continued price hikes, or indeed they're already at a very high level. And what this means is the cash flow and the kitties they need to look after are looking extremely nervous. And for many, coming out of the pandemic, cash positions weren't in a fantastic position already. And for many, perhaps now in the next 6 to 12 months, they see an issue with going into the red, where the business won't be viable in a year's time if price pressures continue in the way they're looking to continue.
Yes, it sounds pretty grim, doesn't it? The difficulty, though, as you say, is that everybody realises now that there were a lot of mistakes made around inflation and about how quickly inflationary pressures would pass. And the longevity of the issue is the very problem, surely, for government. I mean, in terms of extracting a kind of short-term package of measures out of the government, they're going to be rather unwilling, aren't they, given how long this inflation is going to last?
That's right. And what we're calling for is the issue is if we wait for the autumn budget, the measures will no doubt end up being reactive, as in most of the issue and most of the damage will have likely occurred in the intervening period between now and that upcoming autumn budget. So what we're looking for is some proactive measures to give the best support possible at the moment in a proactive nature. So the business community can do its best to make it through what are going to be a fairly embattled few quarters ahead.
One of the things we talk about with companies when we've discussed their earnings on Bloomberg is pricing power. Do your members not have the power to price on to pass on this inflation to their customers?
Well, it's fascinating you say that. So we're seeing record-breaking factory gate price rises. And what I mean when I say that, I mean the rate at which businesses to their end consumer, whether that's a business consumer or indeed the final market, they're raising at record rates. What's actually happening is that the rate of input prices is raising at an even faster pace. So it's almost like a dog chasing its tail, really, which is the prices are being passed down through the system at an alarming rate, but the rate at which the input prices are increasing, businesses aren't passing through the cost at a fast enough rate. If it gives any context as well, we talk a lot about consumer price inflation, which is set to run at a very high rate, anywhere between 8 and 11%, depending on who you talk to. But what's even more pertinent for the business community is the producer price inflation rate, which tracks the rate of cost increases in input, so i.e. in the supply side of the economy. And that's running at 18.6% to the year, which is obviously a massive figure. And it's also the highest figure ever recorded by the ONS, and that's been 2 months consecutively now at that rate.
Okay, so what should government be doing about it then?
Well, we think in the short term, as in we need action now in order to avoid whatever disasters may come if action is not taken, we think pragmatic steps to ease a business's cash flow and the onus on their liabilities. So waiving and reducing business rates is a good tool at the government's disposal, and not dissimilar to what we saw during the pandemic, the implementation of VAT deferrals or completely waiving those VAT onuses for SMEs. And to tackle the unique issue of energy pricing, to temporarily freeze the climate change levy, and if it continues, to look at the option of removing it completely.
Would you be happy for business to chip in a bit more tax to pay towards some of these measures?
Well, the question with that was that it would need to be a long-term view to that, because it's certainly something that wouldn't help in the short term, because debt and tax liabilities for businesses are already a limiting factor given this cost environment. Those sorts of things are plans that certainly the business community would be willing to partake in. However, they would want to see it come hand in hand with a long-term plan for the sector over 5 to 10 years that can see a promise of stimulating investment, a pro-business environment, and then certainly the industry is more than willing to contribute to its part. And if higher taxation over the course of a long-term period with a backbone of an industrial strategy and plan, then that can see the best outcome for both industry and the government and the wider economy.
So perhaps a bit of payback over the longer term. James, talk to us about the employment situation. Job openings are still at record levels across the UK, but your members are finding it very difficult to recruit people. That's still going on, is it? That's still a big problem for you.
That's true. And in our latest Manufacturing Outlook research, which publishes today, having to interpret employment figures in a new way because of that, because typically we see the intention to employ represent how much labour there is in the market just by nature of it not being so tight. But at the moment, because as you rightly say, the labour market, and particularly within the manufacturing sector, is so tight, manufacturers are really struggling to get the skills. And what this is doing is it's limiting output. And what we've seen for the past few quarters, and we continue to see in today's research as well, is an output gap forming where demand for the sector's products is outpacing their ability to supply. And of course, there's a cocktail of reasons why this is, notably raw material access issues. But of course, that shortage of labor is feeding the fire as well. The latest vacancies data for the ONS shows that it's 4 jobs per 100 in the manufacturing sector are vacant, which is the highest it's ever been in that ONS time series that goes back about 30 years or so. Now, for a poignant comparison, in that same month, the latest data, the retail sector only has 3.6 vacancies per 100. Now, of course, if we think about the retail sector, that's typically more transient work, more part-time work, and perhaps a smaller proportion of long-term career jobs than the manufacturing sector, which typically long-term full employment jobs. And so that really drives home just how severe and perhaps uniquely challenged the manufacturing sector is with its skill shortage.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.